listened to every single podcast on oneofus.net. What do I do now?
Well, first of all, how is that even possible? But secondly, I think I have a solution for you, Chris.
There can be no solution, Brian.
There is a solution, and that solution is our newest sponsor, Audible.com. Guys, if you haven't tried Audible.com, now is the perfect time to do that. We're talking about content that includes over 150,000 audio programs. We're talking about books on digital, audio dramas, broadcasters, magazine and newspaper publishers, all the greatest stuff you can possibly imagine in one place just for you.
Okay, that actually does sound pretty good.
Doesn't that sound great? And you know what? I'm going to make it sound even greater, Chris, because they are officially, Audible is officially one of our sponsors here at oneofus.net, and as a special gift to you guys, Audible is giving away a free audiobook. All you have to do is click on the link at the bottom of this page, or you can go to audibletrial.com/oneofus.
You mean to say that by clicking on audible.com and downloading their free book, they make sure by listening to that audio that we keep making more audio as well?
That's right, and the cycle continues.
Live from an undisclosed location deep within the central depths of Hong Kong, it's Dystopian Present. I'm Ross, and I'm joined by my co-hosts,
Brigitte Snipe,
Alan,
good evening all, and welcome to the land of parallel trading. We're going to kick off this evening with a couple of local bits of Hong Kong tomfoolery. Beginning with the fact that the Hong Kong people have decided to reject wholesale retailers, and
I think you should actually define parallel trading.
Let's define it then.
Parallel trading is one of those words.
Economic-y terms.
I wouldn't even call it an economic-y term. It's kind of a local words that don't mean exactly what they mean. What it actually means is gray market trading.
Right. So basically, people come down from mainland China where foodstuffs are unpalatable and unsafe and usually comprised of building materials, and buy baby powder and
Yakult,
which
and
is
anything
really
one of the liquidators
materials
did not need.
Yeah. Okay. And bring it back and sort of sell it in
for a marginal profit.
And is it all just because
is it a marginal profit? Well, it can't be that much because they would otherwise be able to bring in trucks. So you're having people who are doing small trading, often sometimes on an organized basis. I mean, there's a sense of many people coming in and buying small consignments, and perhaps they're.
I thought that was because of the restrictions on how many you could buy
on
more
milk powder, yes, but not on other things.
Fair.
And
just a quick recap for the folks at home, the milk powder thing is basically because milk powder in China is death.
Has had many, many, scares is the wrong word.
Fatalities.
Fatalities.
Which are scary.
Which are scary, and there are a lot of reasons why people are very reliant on milk powder, which is also, of course, aggressively marketed.
Right, right.
But
particularly babies, we're really talking about baby formula,
right?
Yeah. So actually, the degree to which this stuff is traded as a parallel or gray good suggests that, like packets of cigarettes in post-war Vienna, it
or
has
jail.
Actually achieved or jail. It's
or
actually
jail.
Achieved kind of currency level.
Oh, really? So that's going to cost you two cans of infant super smart A plus.
And something like that. And there's also a kind of, there's also clearly a hierarchy of sources, and the Hong Kong market is.
Okay, so let's bottom line this. The main thing now is that Hong Kongers are not taking it anymore, and they're actually beating up mainland traders in the street. How do you tell if someone's, I suppose the amount of baby powder they have on them is the main indicator.
Show me your powder.
Well, it's actually an issue about, kind of ongoing rhetoric about Hong Kong for Hong Kong people and the inability to arrive at a form of political consensus outside of an artificial consensus within government about, who is Hong Kong for? And since people can't formulate a positive discourse, or people are not being allowed to, ways of formulating a negative discourse are coming to the fore. This is actually what happens when you put down Occupy, which
right.
is looking for a positive political definition. You instead get this really xenophobic this really xenophobic movement may be too strong, but let's say...
No, I do not think it is too strong.
Okay.
And when you're seeing counter-protests on the Chinese side of people coming through carrying signs being like, I am not a day trader, which you could translate roughly into, I am a human being deserving of respect.
Right, or so, I keep stocks for more than 24 hours at a time.
Yeah.
I am not a day
But this is also a, you know, this is part of a larger kind of rhythm in Hong Kong life of an annual scandal, which is about keeping the mainland at bay, whether this is mainland mothers, whether this is...
Mainland drivers.
Mainland children taking over school places. And this always has the same structure. What
right.
has changed is that over the course of the last year, people have really gotten very adept at what used to be called flash mobbing, but basically virtually organizing protests
right.
and manifestations. And they're now taking this towards rioting.
And have we seen the counter-protests from the Chinese before? Because I have been in Hong Kong for almost 2 years, and you want to get a Hong Kong person talking, you get them talking about mainland Chinese, and they tell you in great detail why they are dirty and rude and a number of other things.
So you're basically incenting these riots. You're going around sort of fomenting violence.
I personally am the cause of all this, but...
I have seen her along the border.
Have we seen
actively.
Huge mainland Chinese engaging with Hong Kong in the same way? I have some mainland Chinese friends, and their feeling about Central was that they were entitled children who should
right.
be grateful for the protecting arm of Mother China.
Right.
Father China? I don't know how they have referred to it.
It's Mother Father.
Mother Father
Much China. Like Xi
Jinping. Okay, fair enough. So
Mother Father
I'm wondering if there's a rising sense in China to counterbalance the prevailing sense in Hong Kong, or if that's just...
That sounds scary, because rising China
because
kind of...
There's a rising xenophobia
boom.
In China that we've seen, or nationalism in China that's been fomented for quite some time.
The way this was manifested during not last year's panic, but panic the year before last, which was the one which generated the whole locust thing.
Right.
There were various academics from Beijing who leaked various things onto the Chinese language internet, in which they called out people in Hong Kong for their bad character and called them all imperialist dogs.
Mm.
And so that's right up there with mainland
insults. You kind of don't get much worse than that.
Yeah, no, it was really kind of seriously off the hook, and so that was how that was run mm-hmm. 2 years ago. So there have been various forms of pushback, and that's a kind of official, unofficial.
And we have
seen,
as we talked about the last time, a continuing stream of comments from official Chinese party leaders about harmonious sheep-like living in
right.
Hong Kong, etc. So,
but some sheep just like to headbutt. All right.
Speaking of which,
all right.
This past weekend was the one of the biannual openings of Government House, which is one of Hong Kong's many buildings with which no one knows what to do.
Right.
Is it like the White House, or is it more like?
Well, it was the Governor's House,
like Monticello.
Yeah, it's not. Because then we can talk about
with less
it's past
sleeping
incumbents.
With slaves in.
Well, who knows? In Monticello, we can talk about people who lived there, whereas at Government House, we can't.
We can't talk about people who lived there because we don't acknowledge their governors because they were British and we don't like them.
We really can't talk about what Hong Kong is like.
Is that the building that's too close to the Bank of China building and so has moved its Feng Shui-ness away?
It's the one that's behind... Well, it's between the Botanical Garden and the Zoological Garden in what is essentially a great big traffic island.
Right.
Sounds lovely.
And it has, for a central sort of extensive grounds, and actually the reason that the opening is timed... at this time is that the azaleas are supposed to be in bloom.
Right.
In their famous azaleas.
Right.
This is both
important.
Politically
but are they blooming?
No. But they are officially blooming.
We have lost the mandate of heaven.
So it's like the cherry blossoms of Washington, D.C. They are never blooming for the festival.
Yes, it's like that. These are the azaleas of disappointment. And this time, the azaleas of disappointment were being apparently garnished by a spontaneous appearance of Meng Changying's now globally famous and somewhat unhinged eldest daughter. There's a younger daughter somewhere who is apparently waiting to make her debut, unlike his son, who has already appeared in the spotlight and stepped immediately back out.
And why is he important? Who is this person?
He's the chief executive.
Don't worry. Our audience is fully aware of the inner workings of Hong Kong politics because we had that big Occupy movement for a while and everyone was watching that.
And no one has forgotten anything.
Exactly. Nothing else has happened in the world since
then. He's actually largely kept in mind in the public consciousness here by the creativity of the ongoing Cantonese punning insults on his name and elective figures.
Right.
So, even after Occupy, there's really a significant kind of garnishing of Hong Kong with things that say, 7689 and
right. So he opened up Government House. The azaleas disappointed, and then.
And then his daughter wandered out and talked about how she was being pursued by the demons of her family, with too many people, frankly, agree.
Okay.
Is this before or after she realized the building was not tall enough for her to jump out the window?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I feel on the one hand, that there's a kind of, that she does seem to be manifesting kind of some real distress as well as a kind of colossal kind of epic foot in mouthness.
Well, she is 23 and still living at home.
Yes, but she's ready to go.
Everybody lives at home until they're married in this town, though.
And even afterwards.
even if you're living at both Government House and in Kowloon Tong in a secret basement.
Right. You live at both homes.
And in all the secret basements at once. but the point about Government House is that it's kind of where they live, but also not.
Right.
And it's open to the public, but also not. It was opened, the way we found out that it was opening in the, looking at the English language press, was an announcement offered by the government, or a request not to have people come and protest.
Oh.
It's good to do that.
We're open, but just not that kind of open.
Yes, but please don't come and say anything about the government.
No umbrellas, please.
And there was a small umbrella protest and a much larger kind of social justice for domestic helpers protest. And then there was a line of people whom I have never seen in Hong Kong.
Right.
All the way around to the HSBC building.
Which is far away for folks at home.
We're talking many, many school buses worth.
Yes.
Of people, some of whom were there as tourists for the day, others who may have given up peril trading briefly to come and see the azaleas that weren't there. But it was a notably different crowd.
Father China wants us to protest. Let us all go and block the protest with our protest.
Well, it was more, let's go block the protest with our azalea viewing.
That's a very serious business.
Yes. Keep staring,
very
they'll appear.
Serious.
Right, so moving on in Hong Kong terms,
But we can't!
We must! Okay, final thing in the local scene to which Alice and I are going to have a knockdown, drag-out fight, is I believe, for all you music fans out there, that one of the seminal places to go in the world today to enjoy post-shoegaze music, if you really just like to slowly thrash your head against a large speaker, you do it here in Hong Kong. Now, you're looking at me quizzically and questioningly. If you do go, yes, once a year we have this Clock and Flat Festival, and if you go and see most of the local bands, names like The Yours, My Little Airplanes, these guys are very, very noise rocky, bent over the guitars.
I think you just they're just making up. My foot is stuck on this pedal, and I can't get it off.
Okay.
We shoot it.
Well, okay, so fine. So maybe there's a new genre of music Ross likes. And okay, so this all sort of kicked off with the fact that couple of weeks ago, actually about a month ago, swans came through town and just for 3 hours just threw noise at a very small crowd of people. And I was surprised to see how diverse and varied. You had like old gray-bearded rockers like myself. You had young Hong Kong kids. You had everybody in between. It's what is, I suppose, interesting about this for me is the number of bands. Hong Kong doesn't get a lot of foreign acts, but the acts that it is getting are very in-your-face, noisy. Now, I don't think you consider this UK outfit yuck that's coming in a couple of weeks in that genre.
I don't consider them canonical.
Okay, no, fine, fair enough. However, you don't get small, noisy, grungy bands rocking up in Singapore. Or, I mean, you get in Tokyo, but everything comes to Tokyo.
Yeah, but you know, Jakarta's full of metal. I think that there's a kind of, I mean, I think there's an issue about kind of marginal survival.
Yes.
And also in terms of, let's say, an open lyrical palette.
Okay, which you think that Hong Kong in the canto pop world? I mean, most music that's listened to in Hong Kong is very poppy, very sort of bog standard, just
grim, frankly.
Yeah. So the fact that all this stuff exists in Hong Kong, I'm just happy that I can rock out. Can you give me that, Alice?
I think we can allow that, but. But I think that you maybe have to look for a kind of wider pattern of both kind of generic survival.
Right.
And also kind of what is the sort of half-life of touring noise bands.
Right. Okay, fine. So maybe this is where struggling noise bands come to die.
But struggling noise bands are better than the no concert scene that we've
Well, that's but that's
had.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. Like, sort of, you know, if you're starving in a rock of made up of canto pop, you really, to paraphrase, or Eddie Murphy, really dig that saltine.
I think that canto pop is not being is not being listened to by what we could even generously call the young,
right?
And that kind of probably more people are listening to acoustic mando pop that
right.
are listening to noise rock.
Right.
But there are things that have a much... Or indeed, of course, K-pop, which is still a juggernaut.
Can of worms. Don't open it.
Okay.
Fine. So here's the deal. I'm going to take you to the concert, and we'll report back next episode.
See, this is interesting to me.
Sounds fair enough.
This is very interesting because... As far as I knew, the only music in Hong Kong were Filipino house bands and Lan Kwai Fong catering to old white men with small Filipina girlfriends.
Which tells you...
That tells you more.
It only just tells me where you are at 2 a.m. on a Saturday night.
I'll be quiet now.
But if you think about what comes to Hong Kong, you get the big art fairs, which are selling to mega millions buyers. We just had Art Basel, which is very exciting, and the Central Hong Kong Art Basel.
Basel is the Thai cooking
festival. Right. Also true.
And we get by poetry oregano.
And we get the Hong Kong Sevens, which is a drunken rugby extravaganza.
And it's so naff.
But we
so
don't
naff.
Really get anything else. So,
yeah.
If I were not going to be out of town, I would totally show up at the Yacht concert because...
Right.
We need to encourage more artistic endeavors beyond the Filipino house bands in Hong Kong.
And
but
although
I think we were trying to rap, and I was
no, that's fine. I almost want to post a defense of the rugby sevens, but I will say
no,
this. Okay,
no, don't.
All right, so fine.
It's not good. I saw a bunch of girls last year wearing like I Dream of Jeannie outfits, and
right.
they were like 12 potentially. It was disturbing.
Yes, yeah, no. I
Maybe
know.
That's why my son enjoyed it so much.
Probably
right.
yes.
He was only 10, though.
Right.
I think that's around the age. Anyway.
All right, moving to the global scene. what have we noticed in the world of global geekery? I had thrown out some things that apparently didn't resonate with you all that much.
Us Philistines?
Yes. What did you Philistines take away from the world of genre last couple of weeks?
Modern Eagle.
Yes, that's right. It has been that long.
Yes. And you just think, you know, 2 weeks go by and, you know, like a shooting star.
The cosmic ballet continues.
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed in a lot of the obituaries about Nimoy. I know that obviously Star Trek was the main thing, but nobody seemed to kind of get into the rest of him, and I'm not talking about like The Hobbit.
Well, I would say the big reason for this is that obituaries in general have gotten weaker for everyone. Now in this current culture of you're known for one big thing, they touch upon your life so briefly, and it's more about, oh, we noticed that he died, rather than a celebration or even an interrogation of what he has done throughout for anyone.
I think that the shape of it was a little bit overdetermined by the reboots and his fairly prominent role in them as the, you know, kind of the only original Star Trek cast member who was having a major role in this kind of, in the most recent film. And I think that had a tendency. They might not have been the obits that were written of Leonard Nimoy 4 years ago. I'm not speaking of kind of the spiraling death of journalism there, but just
something
more about the entertainment cycle.
Right.
He did very well out of a career that would have, you know, think of Mark Hamill.
Mark Hamill has had a very successful career that no one has paid attention to.
Yes,
but he's actually, Leonard Nimoy is someone who really managed to escape that.
Leonard Nimoy
and managed
also
to remain both famous and working.
And liked, which was sort of interesting if you look at, if you wrote potentially an obituary about Bill Cosby today, it would be very different than it would have been 3 years ago, whereas Leonard Nimoy managed to maintain his sort of
part of that.
I was wondering where you're going with this. He managed to keep everything in the closet.
He was very well liked, and I think the number of people who get to that are shrinking every day.
I think a big reason for that is because the character, his most well-known character, was someone who was not an emotional creature. So he was a cipher for anyone who watched.
Certainly.
He was that original geek icon for those who felt they didn't fit in. They could project themselves upon him rather than on the other characters who had a defined emotional character.
Well, I think that has more to do with the reception of the death of Spock than it does to the death of Leonard Nimoy.
Right.
And I'm sorry, but for most people, that is the same.
But part of
photographing very heavy women, like
he's
that
got a permanent photo display somewhere in New England.
Yes, I'm also photographing nude women in Toledo. But
yeah, he had a weird relationship with his religion. I mean, he grew up fairly Orthodox. Weird but intense. I mean, Yiddish was his first language.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
We stand corrected.
We have a fact-checking team here at Dystopian Present Studios. It was not, but he did speak it at an early age.
Grew up in Yid?
Yes. He spoke it poorly in later life, but he kind of, as I understood it, he kind of went through a bit of a hippie trippy yet somewhat Orthodox rediscovery of his religious roots later in life, hence the weird photographs.
If we were going to recommend something for people to look at, what would be our one Spock recommendation or Leonard Nimoy? I just did it again. Our Leonard Nimoy recommendation for folks at home.
I would go back to the Simpsons clip.
Because we're that classy.
Well, I think that his ability, and I think this comes back to this issue, that why Leonard Nimoy was kind of able to deal with the fame of being iconic is that he was able to present himself both as this character and as not this character at the same time. And that, you know, part of the trick was kind of being humanistic.
Which goes back to his double biographies. I am not Spock, I am Spock.
No, and I think he was constantly working across this. But the fact that he had a sense of humor about it is all redeeming.
Yes.
And the fact that he's the one creative force behind a Star Trek series, movie, anything that was not about violence and killing. You know, the story and
directing not only
of
he, not
Star Trek 4 was all about the
that one.
That was my favorite movie when I was six.
I
watched it so many times.
He came up with the story as well as directing.
And, you know, you're overlooking, the most important thing,
but
which is that his Star Trek legacy is helping to eclipse Three Men and a Baby.
And forget he directed
Speak
that one.
Not of that abomination with a ghost. There's a ghost in it.
All right, moving swiftly on. Other notable genre icons that have died. Terry Pratchett.
Oh, yes.
I've heard of him.
Yes, as have I, but I confess, I've not really read much of him.
Neither.
No. Anybody?
Well, I'm not the right person to speak for that.
When I first read a Discworld book, I was not yet aware of who he was and what the style of those books was. So it caught me off, and I didn't enjoy it. It's all angry and, it's not real fantasy, blah, blah, blah.
Because it was too winky and self-referential?
Yeah, it was on, and this is strange because I loved that type of book. I just wasn't aware that his was that type of book.
You took a drink expecting milk and got a Coke and you were...
And it ruined him. But then later, I rediscovered him through his partnership with Neil Gaiman. And then
that is a good book.
Went back, read a few things, and he did do... Oh, table noise! Table noise! I went back and rediscovered a few of his things, and my son has gotten into it. So I have a cursory familiarity. I mean, he was very creative and very, what's the word I'm looking for? He wrote a lot.
Prolific.
Thank you.
Well,
in Cantonese, that would be Hutai.
Well done.
I think that one thing that I just want to kind of toss in is that he was the British establishment of kind of thinking about the literary production or the British literary establishment is not as good at assimilating genre as some others, and he was someone who kept it, you know, he was the face of genre fiction in a kind of very serious way.
I do have to say they adapted some of his stories very well on the BBC.
Oh, cool.
And made it much more accessible to the general public.
It also seems kind or proper to acknowledge that he was, at the end of his life, an advocate for death with dignity and sort of other similar causes, which I think is kind of cool.
And a very effective one.
Do we know if his...
death was chosen or...
Yes.
No.
I don't think it
no,
was.
No, we don't know. No,
no
it
no,
wasn't.
No, the announcements announced that it was not.
Okay.
But still.
Yeah, no, that is a good point. Yeah, no, early on when he was diagnosed, if you recall, reading, I mean, again, I've read nothing by him, but obviously you don't.
He wrote some very effective pieces about death with dignity and sort of living the life that you choose, which is a hard thing to write about. And so just sort of when we look at his body of work,
and because he was the kind of figure he was, and with such a wide readership, particularly in Britain, he actually really influenced political debate and also opened these topics up to people who would not have otherwise dealt with them or been able to deal with them.
Okay.
And I'm sure at his next opportunity, he will be able to choose it.
I hope that you're correct. So,
moving swiftly on.
Oh, wait, the waiter. Four more, please. Thank you.
So, what are we consuming besides
Xiao Long Bao?
Well, you know, I'm not a big Xiao Long Bao fan, but
that's like not allowed.
No, I know. Well, yeah,
you're dismissed.
Anyways, I'm not talking. I'm talking about what your mind is consuming, man.
The soup dumplings of the soul.
Yes, Alice. What are your soup dumplings of the soul?
Well, we're very pleased in the Alice household that the Flash is back after its hiatus.
It's back. It's back for more.
It's back and good.
That's funny. It's not airing on any local channels.
Shush.
Why? Why? Carry on. Actually, it is. An unusual.
Never mind.
Okay.
Keep it rolling, folks.
But also on the in the world of mysteriously obtained entertainment, we've been watching a series that debuted a couple of years ago. It's now about to start its third season, but we're just finishing up the second. Called Peaky Blinders.
Okay.
It's on my list. It's a gangster saga set in fantasy Birmingham, heavily both the art direction
of Birmingham to be in,
really. Mm. The kind of art direction and the kind of general mise en scène is inflected by the use of kind of 90s goth rock. And has a fantastically atmospheric use of Red Right Hand and various covers of Red Right Hand.
Is it set in the 90s or is it
it's set in 1919.
Each of those emphatic hand gestures.
Yes, and I'm.
It was the Red Right Hand.
I just whacked the table. Hi, right. Red Right Hand. And
it's red now.
Moving on.
And it's called Peaky Blinders, which is cool.
Yes.
Yes, and it's the only thing they haven't been kind of brave enough to attempt is actual Birmingham accents, which are the worst.
Well, we wouldn't be able to understand anything if they
had. You could understand it, you would just wish you would.
Okay, Rachel, what are you up to?
I've been reading a little bit, because, you know, I do that.
Yes, Rachel, book check time.
Technical manual?
No, but you're supposed to be reading, like, a book a day, more or less, right?
More or less. So,
okay.
I'm ahead. I'm 20 books ahead of schedule on my reading schedule for myself. So that's great. I would like to recommend The Worst of Robert Jackson Bennett, who wrote a book that got a lot of coverage called The City of Stairs last year, which was very genre, very sort of. It was a steampunk sort of book, and it got a lot of coverage. So I went back and read American Elsewhere, which was the one that when you were reading about them, people were like, you know, he's really good, and no one gave him any credit because he didn't write genre enough stuff. It took me 200 pages to get into this book, which is very unusual. Usually at that point I quit because it was a 600-page book, but I really liked City of Stairs, so I just kept going, and it was really good.
Okay.
It was weird, and it had physics, and it was excellent, and evil gods and bad mommies, and I strongly recommend it.
Okay.
And so I would check it out. And while I'm recommending books, I would also recommend a book that I'm reading now called The Bone Clocks, which is by David Mitchell, who is a fairly famous author, so he doesn't actually need any help.
Cloud Atlas guy, right?
The Cloud Atlas guy. And I tried to read Cloud Atlas 6 times, and every time was like, no, I just can't get into this.
At this point, I say give up.
But I really, really like The Bone Clocks, and I'm 20 pages in, and I'm 20% in, because I read through Kindle, so it's by percentage, not by pages, as we all know.
Right.
And I don't want to be at work, because I'd rather be reading the book. Do you know when you're taking your cell phone with you to places that are not really logical, like to get a coffee so that you can read while standing next to the coffee machine pressing the button?
Hang on. Are there places that are not logical to take a cell phone?
I'm going to answer that question.
Into the pool.
We'll just go with, I really recommend this book.
Got it.
And I'll be back with more reading. Oh, Miss Marvel, the comic adaptation by G. Willow. I don't remember.
An adaptation.
It's a comic book.
Yeah, it's a comic book.
It's a new take on the character.
It's an Inhuman character from the big Terrigen.
And it's really quite good.
But it's very good.
I recommend it.
I agree. It tackles a hero from a different culture.
Yes. She's Pakistani, and she's from Jersey City, which is a lot to overcome for anyone, even a superhero.
Right.
Oh,
absolutely.
Which is a different culture again.
I agree. excellent comic.
So, Mr. Snide, what else is up?
So, what I am currently consuming, I recently discovered, because I live in Hong Kong and for many years and completely out of the loop on what's really going on in America, I found a show from a couple of years ago, Eagle Heart. It's an Adult Swim show, live action, starring Chris Elliott. And it's basically a take on the cop show genre in general in a very bizarre, oddball fashion. First episode, let's say, he spends the first 5 minutes flashing back to every time he tried to take down this big drug lord, and the guy kills his partner and would adopt the partner's look as tribute. And then finally gets the drop on the guy and doesn't manage to kill him, just gives him brain damage. Can't kill him because now he's mentally feeble, and so nurses him back to health until he can kill him properly.
Sounds edifying. It's Adult Swim.
It's actually
let's
quite fantastic. There are layers to it, and right. The comedy is lowbrow enough yet highbrow enough at the same time.
Right.
So, don't they call that the middle brow?
So finally, I don't know which brow this is going to land on, but I'm 57% through in Kindle terms. Kazuo Ishiguro's latest book, The Buried Giant, which is his kind of...
That.
Yes, and I think you should. I mean,
and I will,
at the
as
50s,
soon as it comes through the library.
Okay.
You support your local library.
I thought you were taking your phone to inappropriate places.
Yeah, you can borrow Kindle books on your library. I have 4 library cards for this purpose. All right, time for
dang, careful. Okay, so... Remains of the Day. What's the
Never Let Me Go?
Thank you.
Good.
Yeah. So he's not like everyone's freaking out because he's getting into genre, but he kind of
Never Let Me Go is genre.
Yeah, he's kind of like the Margaret Atwood of Japanese Anglophiles. That in that way that he has.
We have all been waiting.
So
an important
Arthurian legends, Arthurian legends, or post Arthurian legends. He tries to bring in. He tries to have a Tolkienist fantasy world that is also set in ostensibly real Middle Ages. So this is the conceit.
Tolkien wasn't.
No.
Is he new? Tolkien.
Yeah, no, you know, you might have heard about him on other lesser podcasts, but
no.
So the point here is that he's trying to have it all. He's trying to like present an accurate picture of life in the Middle Ages, but also throw in ogres and trolls. And
I think those were there.
Okay. And so does he. So at 57%, I give it an enthusiastic thumbs up. And
I am so glad, because the last time we met, you said you were hate reading and hate watching everything. That
yes, that's right.
So this is
I was sad and hateful in our last episode.
And I'm going to recommend reading Robert Holdstock instead.
Okay, fine.
I promise to hate for us next time.
Thank you. And with that, thank you all for listening to this highly noisy, highly abbreviated version of Dystopian Present. Until the next... What is a 3-week period? I said tricycle, but that's clearly not right.
Trinary?
Until the next...
Until next time.
Until the next time. Good night.
Our order's here.